Our next case is 13-0167, State of Ohio versus Randall Bonnell. For the appellant, Mr. Lutucka.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Francisco Lutucka, and I represent Randall L. Bonnell, Jr. At this time, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before the court today is whether Ohio's trial courts must abide by the straightforward statutory mandates of the consecutive sentencing statute located at Revised Code 29-29-14C4. In deciding this issue, the court will necessarily decide whether Ohio's appellate courts may presume findings for the record or substitute their own findings for those never made at the trial court level. The statute at issue is unambiguous. The statements made by the trial court on page 14 of the sentencing transcript for Mr. Bonnell do not constitute the findings required by Revised Code 29-29-14C4.
Counsel, that gets me to the first question in this case. I can't quite figure out. When the trial court says, court makes the following findings, and at one, it says the defendant's lengthy prison record. Is that what you're taking issue with, that sentence?
No, Your Honor. What Mr. Bonnell is taking issue with is both those findings made in the entry as well as what was regarded as findings by the Fifth Appellate District at the sentencing hearing where the court noted that Mr. Bonnell had an atrocious record, that he had showed little respect for society, and that it had reviewed the pre-sentence investigation. Those, the Fifth District found, constituted the findings at the hearing. The findings at the entry were the findings just cited. Neither, on their own or combined, constitute the three-part analysis required by the consecutive sentencing statute. Those findings were never made in Mr. Bonnell's case, yet he was still sentenced to consecutive sentences.
Is this some talismanic incantation that you want us to write that trial judges are now going to have to recite?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay, so what is this three-part analysis you're talking about?
The three-part analysis set forth in Revised Code 29-29-14C4 asks the trial court to first find whether the consecutive sentences are necessary to punish the offender or protect the public from future crime. That constitutes the first finding. The second finding is whether the consecutive sentences are disproportionate to the seriousness of the conduct and the danger the offender poses to the society. And then the third finding that is required, a court may choose one of three findings. One, the offender was on post-release control, awaiting sentencing or trial when the crime was committed. Alternatively, that two or more of the crimes were committed in one course of conduct, and that the harm caused by those two or more crimes was so great or unusual that consecutive sentences are warranted, or alternatively, that the offender's history of criminal conduct demonstrates a need to protect the public from future crime. That is the three-part analysis that the statute requires.
And so if the court makes the determination about the necessity to protect the public in the first instance, does it also have to do it in the third instance? Does it have to make it twice?
Your Honor, the first is forward-looking regarding future crime or punishment of the offender.
The other is with respect to the history of the defendant. And my question is, does the court have to make that determination twice?
The court must make the first and the third finding. In the third occasion, it must make it again if it chooses one of the other two. Arguably, one finding could constitute both the first and the third. Yes.
So, counsel, you'd have us go back to the Comer days when the court would just look at the statute and then basically read from the statute. And if that's on the record, the Court of Appeals would have to affirm the court. Is that what you want?
That is one kind of relief that Mr. Bonnell would request. However, that seems to request magic or talismanic words by reading the statute
verbatim. And that's
verbatim.
Exactly what would happen. you would have a situation where instead of eye-to-eye contact and a sentence that was tailored to an individual with the reasons that, for example, this judge gave regarding the sentence, instead of that, you would have a judge just reading from a script and then being upheld on appeal.
No, Your Honor. That would be a situation where the court would make the findings. The findings could be made by a verbatim recitation of the statute. The findings could also be made by setting forth rationales or reasons which would support the findings. As such, there's no request for magic or talismanic words. Certainly.
Why would you not consider what was on this record to be the reasons for the sentence and the reasons for the consecutive sentence?
Your Honor, these may constitute reasons. They, however, do not constitute the findings needed to overcome the statutory presumption for concurrent sentences. The remarks made were effectively that Mr. Bonnell had an atrocious record, had showed little respect for society, and that the pre-sentence investigation had been reviewed by the court. Charitably, that could constitute the third finding, which is that Mr. Bonnell had a history of criminal conduct that demonstrated the need to protect the public from future crime.
Well, I don't think you even have to be charitable. You can go to simple math, can't you, in this case? The trial court said that since he became an adult, he had 44 convictions or arrests. And I always have trouble with these cases. I mean, maybe I'll learn it today. What's the difference between a finding and a reason?
Your Honor, reasons or rationales may support a finding. The findings are set forth in the statute. The reasons or rationales that a court may cite or discuss can support those findings, and that's what an appellate court will look to upon review. However,
Mr. Ludicky, this statute has been reenacted by the General Assembly. You'd agree to that, right? That's why we're here.
Correct, Your Honor.
It doesn't say to state reasons, does it? It just says make the findings.
Correct.
The old statute said you had to make the findings and give reasons. But when the General Assembly reenacted this statute, they omitted the obligation of the trial court to give reasons for the findings. It just said make the findings. Isn't that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So we don't have to talk about reasons any further. Do you agree?
To the extent that reasons were discussed, it was only because the question was, does the statute need to be read verbatim to make findings?
And that's why I asked you at the outset, is this just a talismanic incantation of what this finding is according to what the statute says?
No, Your Honor.
So we don't have to give reasons. You agree with that, correct?
Criminal Rule 32 states that reasons...
I didn't ask you about the criminal rule. I asked you about the statute.
The statute does not require reasons.
Okay. And does a trial judge, in your view, have to provide reasons?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Under the statute, a trial judge may provide reasons or rationale which constitute the findings. Alternatively, a trial judge may also opt to read the findings verbatim.
So then we should look and see what the trial judge did in this case and determine whether or not the reasons it offered for this sentence fit within the ambit of the findings that it had to make.
Correct,
Your Honor. And if we find that those reasons that it gave, such as the atrocious history of your client, fitting either the necessity to punish the offender or protect the public, that could constitute the first and the third finding, because you told me that earlier, right?
Arguably, Your Honor, yes.
And then all we have to do is say whether or not the second finding is made, and then that would be a resolution. Is that fair? Or have I mischaracterized your argument?
If the court could find that the three findings were made based on the record here,
yes,
then yes, that would be fair. The three findings were not made in Mr. Bonnell's case.
And which one is missing?
The proportionality finding. And Mr. Bonnell would posit that the first finding is also not there, because to use past-looking language to make a forward-looking finding about future crime would be improper. So Mr. Bonnell would posit that at best, again, charitably, the third finding was made. The first and the second were not. There was no discussion of proportionality.
So can a court exercise its judgment to determine whether or not an individual who has been arrested or convicted 44 times in the past receives a sentence as being disproportionate or not to the seriousness of the offense?
A trial court can make any judgment it may desire when sentencing an individual. However, by the statute, the requirement is that to overcome the statutory presumption for concurrent sentences.
Yes.
Which results in Mr. Bonnell's sentence being extended from 2.5 years, if served concurrently, to 8 years and 5 months, if served consecutively. Those findings must be made.
And so you do want a judge to say, this sentence is not disproportionate to the seriousness of the conduct. And if the court had said that, you'd have no problem.
If the court had used those words, that would constitute a finding. Similarly, reasons or rationales could have constituted a finding whereby Mr. Bonnell's sentence was compared to that of his co-defendant or perhaps to other individuals that the court had sentenced, something regarding proportionality.
These findings are merely conclusions that the court is asked to, without rationale or without reasons.
Correct. The finding would represent the
They're
conclusion.
They're just conclusions, and there's no justification for those conclusions other than a reference to I've read the PSI and whatever the judge wants to gratuitously throw in there. But as Justice Lansinger said, the judge could have before it a laminated piece of paper that says, you know, I'm going to sentence you to consecutive sentences. These sentences are such and such, and it's based on, you know, these three merely conclusory statements that are being made. Would you agree with that?
Yes, the findings need to be made, and worksheets were approved after Comer, so a court could go about making the findings in that manner.
But counsel, I thought your argument was under the criminal rule, under Rule 32, you would have to have reasons to support those findings. Did I misunderstand that?
No, you did not misunderstand that. Mr. Bonnell would definitely posit that given reading the rule in conjunction with the statute would require not only the findings, but that also the part of the rule requiring findings and reasons are once again relevant given House Bill 86 reenacting this statute.
But doesn't I don't have the language of the rule in front of me. Doesn't it say if appropriate?
Correct, Your Honor. It does say if appropriate.
So if the statute, if we were to find the statute didn't require the reasons, wouldn't that mean that they aren't appropriate or aren't necessary under those circumstances?
Your Honor, it is our position that the statute creates a substantive right which offers Mr. Bonnell the meaningful right to appellate review. Thus, the findings have to be made. The rules language regarding the appropriateness of making reasons perhaps represents where a court might diverge from making a worksheet's finding or simply reciting the language of the statute and would give reasons or rationales that support the conclusions.
And when we're looking at whatever the trial court has done, whether this court or any other, would you agree with the state that the proper standard of review is that expressed by the plurality in Kalish? That
yes.
We look, okay, so you would agree with that?
Yes, the proper standard of review is whether Mr. Bonnell's sentence or of those similarly situated is clearly and convincingly contrary to law.
Okay.
Mr. Bonnell's sentence is clearly and convincingly contrary to law because the findings were not made, yet the statutory presumption for concurrent sentences was not abided by, and he was sentenced to consecutive sentences.
But counsel, you're saying what you're really advocating here today is meaningful appellate review, correct?
Correct.
And yet I've listened to the argument and your responses to the Chief and Justice O'Donnell, and I think what you're saying that you want us to tell trial courts, from this day forward, I want you to look at the laminated card and I want you to say, I'm going to give you consecutive sentences because one, it is necessary to protect the public, two, it's not disproportionate, and three, your history is bad. Is that a valid sentence? And does that lead to meaningful appellate review?
Your Honor, just making the findings leads to a more meaningful appellate review than that which Mr. Bonnell had. Certainly, Mr. Bonnell would posit that what is needed is not only compliance with the statute, but with Criminal Rule 32, and that findings and reasons are truly the appropriate way in which to overcome a statutory presumption for concurrent sentences.
See, I must respectfully disagree with you because I think this trial court was reaching out to the appellate review when he said, it's an atrocious record. It's got 44 instances. I'm sending you away longer than the minimum. But I think you're advocating you don't want all that there.
Your Honor, assuming that the trial court in Bonnell presumably gave reasons or rationales rather than making the verbatim findings, if a court does so, those reasons and rationales must constitute the findings as well. That's statutorily mandated. These reasons and rationales don't reach the proportionality issue. They don't reach the forward-looking future crime issue. They, again, charitably reach the third prong of the third potential finding. They do not reach the other two.
So saying that the sentence is appropriate to you does not mean it's proportionate, and the fact that it says the record is atrocious, the court has given you opportunities, you've shown little respect for society, doesn't reach to the other two. You're saying none of that relates to the findings that need to be made.
No, Your Honor. To shoehorn what the court said as findings is to allow an appellate court to presume that findings were made because consecutive sentences were issued. The statute mandates that a trial court imposing sentence must make these findings. Otherwise, the statute is circumvented because an individual like Mr. Bonnell faces a court with unfettered discretion to issue consecutive sentences.
And what do we do with your client if we see things your way?
A remand for resentencing.
All right. And then I'm just interested, what do you expect to happen at resentencing?
Your Honor, presumably counsel for Mr. Bonnell would argue that this is not proportional and that given the sentence of his co-defendant, who pled to the exact same crimes, received the exact same time on those crimes, and is serving them concurrently, that his sentence would be either some of it would be served.
That was not argued at the time of sentencing.
No. Indeed, that's one of the biggest issues here.
But did the co-defendant have 44 other convictions and arrests?
The only difference, I'm not aware of co-defendant's precise record. The only difference in the two entries when compared, and co-defendant's is in the record, is that when the two findings are made in the sentencing entry, Mr. Bonnell says lengthy criminal record, and his co-defendant, Mr. Bush says criminal record, or simply prior criminal record. That's the only difference. Of course, Mr. Bush was sentenced concurrently, so no findings were necessary.
So no attorney representing Mr. Bonnell at the sentencing hearing pointed out the disparities?
No attorney pointed out that the findings were
not made. So there's no record made at the trial court on this?
On this issue? No. And most likely that's because for a court to make findings, when a court makes findings, it puts a defendant on notice and it allows him the ability to object. However, Mr. Bonnell, because no findings
were sentenced simultaneously?
No. And they were sentenced in two different courtrooms.
Who went first?
Your Honor, I believe Mr. Bonnell was first.
So there was no proportionality from Bush at that time, was there?
Excuse me, I believe Mr. Bush was first, excuse me. Oh. However, they were in different courtrooms before different judges. That said, just looking at the entries, you see that they're identical, yet somehow, in Mr. Bonnell's case, the statutory presumption for concurrent sentences was overcome. And that's really the crux of the issue, is did Mr. Bonnell, when he was sentenced, have noticed that these findings were made against him such that the statutory presumption was overcome? And not only that, but could he have objected? And Mr. Bonnell couldn't have objected because what the court was making was remarks. It wasn't making findings.
Thank you.
Let me take you back to Criminal Rule 32, which does say, as Justice French pointed out, in serious offenses, the court should state statutory findings and give reasons supporting those findings if appropriate. And in that regard, the Division Section 29.29.14 of the Revised Code says that a court may recommend placement of an offender in a program of shock probation or intensive probation, or disapprove of such placement. And it says, if the court recommends or disapproves of such placement, it shall make findings that give its reasons for its recommendation or disapproval. Why is it that if appropriate doesn't have reference to the statutory requirement to make those findings and give those reasons? Why isn't that, if appropriate, relating to this, the code sections that the legislature wants reasons to be given? And here, connection with consecutive sentences, it doesn't require those reasons. Why isn't that a reasonable interpretation?
That may be a reasonable interpretation. Mr. Bonnell would posit that his interpretation is that those reasons may be given as rationales or reasons in lieu of a court that does not necessarily want to make the verbatim findings by just reading the statute.
You realize, of course, your argument is, as Justice Lansinger pointed out, potentially resulting in trial courts simply reading that statute and imposing the sentences consecutively. You realize that?
That is one foreseeable result that will occur in some trial courts. Other trial courts may state reasons.
That would be statutory compliance with this code section, would it not?
Yes, Your Honor. And indeed, what is being requested truly is statutory compliance by Ohio's trial courts.
Thank you. Mr. Pinkell.
May it please the court. My name is Eric Pinkell, appellee on behalf of the State of Ohio and Delaware County Prosecuting Attorney Carol Hamilton O'Brien. The state is asking this court to affirm the decision by the Fifth District Court of Appeals. And the issue before this court, as raised by appellant, is what requirements will be made of this court on trial courts to impose consecutive sentences pursuant to the newly enacted consecutive sentence statute 292914C4. Looking at the entire record in this case, both combining the judgment entry on sentence and the sentencing transcript, the necessary findings were made through a meaningful discussion between the trial court judge and the appellant, in this case, Mr. Bonnell, to get where the appellant wants this court to go. Necessarily, it would have to be magic or talismanic words, and as the case law and Bonnell and others throughout the districts have shown, that is not necessary in order to make the necessary findings here in order to impose consecutive sentences. And the state would like to go through for a minute the statute. There's a lot of redundancy in this statute. There's only one really variation in the second step. The first step accords a trial court to impose consecutive sentences. It must show that it's necessary to protect the public from future crime, or it is written in the disjunctive there, or punish the offender. Here, as one of the justices pointed out, at both the sentencing hearing and in the judgment entry, the court found and said a sentence is appropriate.
Counsel, when we get to proportionality, is there anything in this record to indicate that this trial court judge knew at the time he did the sentence that the co-defendant had received concurrent sentencing?
Your Honor, Mr. Bush was sentenced prior to this, and I do not recall his exact sentence, but no, that was not mentioned at the trial court. At the trial court level here at sentencing. No.
So where in this record do you find that this trial court indicated for meaningful appellate review that this consecutive sentences was not disproportionate?
Your Honor, I would point to two different areas. One, the court did order restitution in both the judgment entry and at the sentencing hearing in the amount of $2,837, which is no small amounts. Basically, disproportionality to the offender's conduct is talking about the crime he committed. So the court did order restitution in a significant amount. In addition, if looking at the judgment entry, the court considered the facts of the case. That's on page 2 of the judgment entry, that the court stated it considered the facts of the case and weighed the principles and purposes of sentencing in 292911 and the recidivism factors in 292912. And also, most importantly, at the appellate court level, the PSI was made a part for the Fifth District, and now Your Honors, so you can look at that. And the trial court specifically mentioned the PSI. A PSI has things like the defendant's educational background, his social, his military, his educational. But most importantly, it has his criminal history that shows his 44 convictions, arrests, prison terms. But it also has the facts of this case. So necessarily, the record shows the court reviewed that PSI, and those facts in the case were reviewed by the court, and that's evident from the hearing transcript and from the judgment entry itself.
But I guess what I'm having trouble with is figuring out the word disproportionality. I'm old enough to remember that, you know, the courts used to have to go through this long litany of, you know, Smith got 10 years and Jones got 15 years and now you get 16 years. Are we now going back to the point where we have to go and weigh if you've robbed a vending machine and you've broken the water line, then you've got to go to away a long time?
It all depends on, in this case, what an individual's criminal history is like. Every individual is going to be different. Mr. Bush was no angel.
So when we talk disproportionality, we're talking about the individual, not the crime?
We're talking about the combination of the two together, looking at the crime in light of the defendant's history. And in this case, it has a defendant that had 44 convictions, arrests. Mr. Bunnell more than earned the sentence of 8 years
but
and 5 months.
But the fact is, he went to the Best Western and a Red Roof Inn and took $117 out of a couple of pop machines in coins.
He did.
He's doing 8.5 years in prison for two pop machines.
And he cost $2,837.
Well, he broke a water line. There's no question about that. There are a lot of those around today.
Yes. Of course, well aware, as am I.
It's unfortunate.
But the fact is, I think in the overall argument, if I'm hearing what Mr. Luttke is arguing to us, 8.5 years seems like a long time for breaking into two pop machines and taking $117 in quarters.
I believe that it was three different hotels over the course of a period of time. This was a man, and if the court looks at this was a man that at arraignment was sentenced on another case and given 120 days at arraignment on this case for, and he was ultimately charged here with engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity, albeit for stealing $117.
Should we be looking at the General Assembly's policy of trying to provide shorter sentences and reduce prison population in a case like this?
I think the focus, obviously the legislature's focus is a little bit wider than this court's focus. It should be on this individual, and individuals deserve to go to prison. And as stated earlier, Mr. Bunnell more than earned his 8 years and 5 months. And he was not charged with mere theft of $117. He was charged with three burglaries.
When we write this opinion, we're going to be telling trial judges all across Ohio what they should be doing. Should they be making findings and giving reasons, in your view, or should they be reciting that statute for consecutive imposition of sentence? Or
Your Honor, it's just,
is there some combination? What is your office's position on that?
Your Honor, the state would state that it can take many forms. That's why the state would suggest that courts, appellate courts, be able to look at the entire record. But yes, specific findings do need to be made pursuant to 2929.14c4.
Mr. Luttke argues that there is no proportionality finding made here. He said if you want to be generous, you can consider with the history that Mr. Bunnell presents, you could make a determination that it's necessary to protect the public based on his history, and therefore incarceration or consecutive sentences are necessary. But the court never addressed the proportionality.
The court reviewed the PSI in this case, which had the facts of this case, and appellate courts are not as in good a position as the trial court was in this case. They heard the arguments from counsel. He read letters from family members. He read the PSI, which had the facts of the case. The micromanaging from an appellate court level on that disproportionality prong of the second step really needs to be given great deference to a trial court.
Counsel, that sounds like an abuse of discretion review. You know, here we're not asking the question, is this sentence reasonable? The question is, did the court make the right findings? And to say that the court looked at the PSI and looked at the whole record, well, that might lead to the sentence, but that doesn't necessarily lead to a finding. So is there anything on the record that you can say points to the trial court did make a proportionality finding?
Your Honor,
Not that the court could have, based on the record, but just whether on this record there is a finding.
There is no nexus between any of the steps outlined in 29, 29, 14, C4, and the discussion.
What does that mean, that there's no nexus?
Didn't say, I find that your history of criminal conduct demonstrates consecutive sentences are necessary to protect the public from future crime because you have 44 convictions. There wasn't that. Here, there wasn't a... the court finds that consecutive sentences are not disproportionate to the seriousness of the offender's conduct. No, we did not. The trial court did not use specific language in that case.
But even giving generously, saying we don't require magic words, is there a statement of any kind by the trial court in this record that suggests that there was a finding that consecutive sentences are proportionate to the seriousness of the conduct and to the danger posed to the public? Is there anything even generously that you can point to?
I would point to the judgment entry on sentence in which the court stated that it considered and weighed the factors of principles and purposes of sentencing in 29, 29, 11, and the recidivism factors in 12, which necessarily have to go through that litany of the offender's conduct as it relates to the case. And this goes back to the point of allowing trial judges to have latitude in making the determination that consecutive sentences are both necessary and appropriate, as they were in this case. And the Fifth District found that these findings, coupled with the court's acknowledgement that it has read and considered the PSI, are sufficient to satisfy the requirements under the consecutive sentencing statute.
So are we basically saying that the record would support what the court did? Is that what you're saying? We have in the statement to the defendant, this is an appropriate sentence, or I find this sentence to be appropriate, which in a sense relates to proportionality, to the fact of this sentence matches your background, et cetera. It would be different had the record not shown any previous convictions. Then you could argue potentially that the findings could not have been made. Are we almost talking about a presumption of regularity here? Is that what you're arguing to us?
Yes, Your Honor. This court should presume regularity in the trial court's proceedings in this case, insofar that it did state that a sentence is appropriate, which does speak to the disproportionate nature of this offender's conduct in this case, and also, again, to point to a question before, that there was restitution ordered in the amount of $2,837. And these were burglaries. This again was not a small petty theft, M1 theft. These were burglaries in which he was breaking into or trespassing into hotels and committing these crimes.
Does it make any difference that the statute does not say the court shall make the following findings, in your view? I mean, it talks about the consecutive sentence. The court may require the offender to serve consecutive prison terms if the court finds. That's the method in which the three statements come. But it does not say the court shall make the following findings, 1, 2, 3. Does that make a difference in your view?
It certainly would show that the decision to impose consecutive sentence is permissive. And that it is not mandated the consecutive sentence, because in the statutes in 29, 29, 41 has revitalized the presumption for concurrent sentences. So I would agree that would weigh in the decision that the trial court was proper in making their findings in this case. And it's important to note here, Your Honor, that, again, the trial court in this case engaged in a meaningful conversation with the appellant, had a conversation, told him about his record, allowed him to speak. This court is reviewing this to go back to the question to appellant from the appellant. This court is reviewing this under the Kalish standard, polarity opinion in the Kalish case, in which first and foremost this court needs to find whether or not this sentence was contrary to law, and as the state has submitted so far, that has not been shown. But even if this court does find that it's contrary to law, then this court is to analyze the sentence under an abuse of discretion standard. And given the meaningful discussion and the steps taken at both the sentencing hearing and in the judgment entry and transcript, this court should not find that the court acted in an arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable
now,
manner.
Counsel, let me read to you what you've written, though. In your brief, you say that the statute supersedes the rule, and therefore the court does not need to state any reasons. Do you stand by that this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
For reasons?
No, it does not need to give reasons. However, in this case, the court did, and the reasons can constitute the findings, or vice versa. Really, it comes down to the meaningful discussion and looking at the total circumstances of the trial court sentencing of an appellant, in this case, Mr.
By Grinnell. Definition, a meaningful discussion means reasons, does it not?
It means findings and reasons, Your Honor, yes. But the only requirement pursuant to 29-29-14-C-4 is that the court make specific findings that have been enumerated in the first in the three steps.
And yet you are inviting us in this case to look throughout the record to find where the court uses the word proportionality, and they do not.
They do not use the word proportionality, nor do they use the word protect the public from future crime, though this court, it should be clear to this court that that is what the trial court was aiming at when it was talking about the 44 convictions and prison terms. There wasn't direct language, that nexus between those other steps, but same with the disproportionate language. Looking at the entire record as a whole, those factors were there, and the imposition of consecutive sentences was appropriate in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Very briefly, Your Honor, you cannot presume regularity where the presumption under statute is for concurrent sentences. That must be overcome by making the findings. The statute does require that findings be made. It states that a court may require a defendant or an offender to serve his sentence consecutively if the court finds, setting forth the three-part analysis. An appellate court and a defendant, as well as appellate advocates, must be able to look to the record to see that the court engaged in the three-part analysis required by statute and selected the appropriate criteria. Anything more is to ask appellate courts to speculate and presume findings, which is not what is dictated by the statute. It does not give an offender notice or an opportunity to object. And it only allows a circumvention of the statute and takes away the ability for a meaningful appellate review of an individual
sentence. So if we agree with you and we require the court to make a three-part analysis and make the specific statutory findings before imposing consecutive sentences, we send this back to the trial court for a resentencing? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the trial court can read that and impose exactly the same sentence if it chooses.
The trial court could presumably do that. It would also listen to argument from counsel.
Of course,
from
it
Mr.
would
Bonnell
listen to argument, but I mean, what you're really asking is for a resentencing.
Yes.
So that the court can make the specific findings pursuant to the statute, or at least put them on the record. And as I'm understanding it, your argument is that there was not a specific reference or a finding on proportionality.
There was no finding on proportionality. As to a previous question made to opposing counsel, the disproportionality is actually an analysis between the seriousness of the conduct and the danger posed to society and the sentence.
How does a trial court determine whether or not its sentence of 8.5 years is or is not disproportionate? Is it within the county? Is it within the state? Is it within the appellate district? What measure should a trial court apply, in your view, to assess proportionality?
Your Honor, it would have to be a case-by-case analysis, perhaps other defendants in that
court. Well, in this instance, let's take this case. What is it you're asking the trial court to do? Were you defense counsel standing there in connection with the court's determination of proportionality?
Your Honor, I would note that his co-defendant, which pled to the exact same charges and received the exact same number of months, is going to be released in April after serving 2.5 years, whereas Mr. Bonnell is going to be released sometime in 2017, I believe, after serving 8 years and 5 months for the exact same charges on the exact same time.
But not the exact same record.
But correct. one with a longer criminal history, which could justify a longer sentence in your view or not?
It may. The trial court would have to analyze Mr. Bonnell's situation, the circumstances, his record, and make a proportionality finding.
How would it do that?
Your Honor, it would have to look to the seriousness of the conduct, which again is property crimes. The plea was for 4 burglaries and a tampering with vending machines. I believe he made out with somewhere under $200. So.
And does it only look to the burglary sentences imposed in Delaware County, or does it look beyond that?
I believe the trial court has discretion to look at
anywhere it wants,
at anything it would like, and with regards to a similarly situated defendant. However, that is why the analysis is set forth in the statute, is so that a judge engages in what is effectively a thought exercise of whether Mr. Bonnell's stealing $200 and breaking a water main from vending machines merits 8 years and 5 months in prison.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?